This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, episode number 9, was recorded on July 3rd, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I'll be joined this week by former market regulator Chris Cook and Saxo Bank commodities chief Ole Hansen. Our topics in this week's episode include this week's inventory data and the OPEC and G20 meeting outcomes. But then I'm going to do something I would never do except during a holiday week when we only have two panelists on the show and plenty of airtime to spare. I'm going to let Chris Cook talk as long as he wants to about crude oil forward spreads. So put on your seatbelt because we're going to go deep on who's trading the back end of the curve and what their motives are. When Chris gets going on this subject, you can count on plenty of strong opinions. Please be sure to download the slide deck for this episode, which you can find on our homepage at macrovoices.com, as we'll be referring to the charts and graphs that it contains throughout this episode. Before we meet this week's expert panel, let's dive right into this week's EIA data. Crude oil drawing down 1.1 million barrels. That's against API setting an expectation of more than a 5 million barrel drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma, though, building 652,000 barrels this week. Gasoline drawing down 1.6 million barrels, but that was offset by distillates building 1.4 million barrels, so almost an even swap there on the finished products. The tape action was down hard in reaction to those inventory numbers because that 1.1 million barrel draw was so much smaller than the expectations set by API, and that only took us down to our previous low of the day. Then something really strange happened. Gasoline really took off to the upside, and quite frankly, I can't figure out what was driving it, but gasoline ended up pulling the crudes back above critical moving averages, suggesting that this big move down that we saw earlier in the week may have actually been a bear trap after all. U.S. production ticked back up to 12.2 million barrels this week. That's up 100,000 barrels. And that's really refreshing because it shows us that the trend that we feared, or that some analysts have feared, toward lower production really isn't happening, or at least it isn't happening yet. Imports up this week to 7.6 million barrels, exports down to 3 million barrels, or 21 million barrels on the week. But now let's meet this week's expert panel. Ole Hansen is head of commodity strategy at Saxo Bank. Ole, you are known as an expert on the commitment of traders' reports, which indicate positioning of large traders in the futures market. So I want to get your perspective on some interesting developments in the latest COT data that have led to quite a bit of confusion among analysts. For example, WTI gross long positioning recently hit a six-year low. So what's going on here and what does it mean?
Hi, Eric, and thank you very much for having me on the show again. Well, I think the market is, first of all, just clearly just showing an extreme increased level of confusion as to where we go next. And I think it's we just have to take a look at how the world is developing right now, where we have uncertainty, especially on the demand side. Supply seems to have been capped by OPEC and Russia now for another 9 months. But into this, we have U.S. crude oil continuing to go up. So it's just creating a lot of confusion about where we go next. And we're seeing basically both long and short positions currently being cut back. The long there last week was really quite amazing, a six-year low there, and it just tells us, I think, overall that this market is potentially not really going anywhere fast in the near future. The market is adopting an increased wait and see and trying to stay alive within this relatively wide range that we're currently seeing. But overall, we can see that we had some weakness now. Just recently, once again, after the June bounce. But nevertheless, the combined long is down to around 400,000. And we have to remember that was above 1.1 million just a year ago. So there's plenty of room in either direction. That's obviously the key takeaway. So we should obviously still be looking out for any major developments which take it out of this current relatively tight range, because there's plenty of room to add positions there.
And Chris Cook is a former market regulator with decades of experience in energy markets.
Good to be here again. Looking forward to it.
Now, listeners, our usual format on this show is to ask each of our panelists a personal question tailored to meet their personal area of expertise, such as the question that I just asked Ole about COT spreads. But we had a listener request via Twitter for a conversation with Chris Cook in particular about crude oil forward curves. And frankly, that's a subject I know better than to ask Chris Cook about unless there's plenty of time for a really detailed answer. So we're going to forego Chris's opening question this week. And at the end of the show, we're going to go deep on a topic that Chris has more to say about than just about anyone else, which is the term structure of crude oil futures and who's doing the trading far out on the curve and what their motives are. But for now, let's get right to the meat of OPEC G20 and why the extension of production cuts announced at the OPEC meeting somehow wasn't enough to stop prices from collapsing on Tuesday. We'll dive into that topic right after this. For our first major discussion topic this week, we're going to examine the OPEC Plus and G20 meetings and discuss why the extension of production cuts, which both Saudi Arabia and Russia have now agreed to, were somehow not enough to save the market from rolling over Tuesday afternoon this week. Let's start with Ole Hansen. Ole, for the benefit of our listeners who don't follow the market quite as closely as you do, please begin with a summary of what actually happened at G20 and OPEC Plus meetings, and then describe your interpretation of what these events mean to the market.
Well, the strong opening we had on Monday was following the G20 meeting, because you could argue that the G20 meeting was both potentially having a positive impact on demand, because US and China agreed to restart trade talks. Nothing firm was really put in place, but just the fact that they came out with that statement, that gave the market just some initial relief that maybe we can see an end of this trade war, which is currently having a negative impact on global growth. So the demand side looked a little bit rosier. And then on the supply side, we once again saw that power these days is not really in Vienna. A couple of times a year, it's when some of the big members, i.e. this time the Saudi Crown Prince, meets with Putin. And they basically came out during the weekend saying that they shook hands on an extension. And for 6 to 9 months, they were both in agreement of that. So that basically led us into a very strong opening Monday morning. What we didn't have to just remember is that the market was already looking for some kind of extension, not because they OPEC wanted to, but because they have to. Because over the last 6 to 9 months, or at least the last 6 months, the focus has increasingly been turning towards the growth side and the demand side. So what happened on following that euphoric opening on Monday was that we were hit with some hard facts. We had leading indicators coming from China and also from the US, both showing continued weakness, and that quickly reversed the focus back to the demand side. So it turned out to be a relatively short-lived excitement. The market needs the extension. It was prolonged by another 3 months into the first quarter, which probably was a necessity, because that is the time of year where demand is weak anyway. So that was the reason for that. And they also once again just mentioned this US shale oil production. And I saw a tweet earlier today where there's a chart put up basically since cuts were started to being agreed back in 2017. I think we had four meetings where cuts or extension has been agreed. During this period, U.S. Crude oil production has risen by more than 3 million barrels a day. OPEC and Russia have, in the meantime, shrunk theirs by 2.2 million. And I think that just really tells us the story. Obviously, quality is one thing. U.S. shale oil is light, so it's not always the best choice for refineries around the world. But overall, U.S. rising production and the current worries about demand, these are really the key factor why we once again fell out a bit yesterday.
And Chris Cook, what is your take on G20 as well as the OPEC meetings?
I take a different view of the role of OPEC. I have thought for maybe a couple of decades now that OPEC is not actually in control of the market the way people think it is. That a different sort of macro structure has been in place for some considerable time. I believe that since the formation of the Intercontinental Exchange in 2001, essentially oil price formation through the Brent complex, the Brent BFOE complex, has essentially been in the hands of a very small number of players, the people who set up the exchange in the first place. Provided there is capital there, it is very easy for the Brent BFOE tail. You know, we're seeing a secular decline in North Sea production, and a very few cargoes now actually essentially control the global oil market price. And, you know, over this period, we've seen the market evolve. I think of this as what is called macro manipulation. It's not something that is unusual in the market. You know, when producers can support prices, then history shows us they will, and they do. And I believe that that's precisely what has happened. So that, you know, the market has become accustomed to thinking that actually we've got this narrative that OPEC's in control. I think OPEC is in zombie mode. It died years ago. And that we have seen one or two key players with a lot of oil, Saudi in particular, have essentially been in control of what's going on in the market. So that's a rather different view. And well, it's also, I'll be talking about later in the context of the oil market curve, the oil market curve, as I will go into, is based on basically financial players. So, well, I'll come back to it. But in my view, the reason why markets are working the way they are and have evolved the way they have in the last two decades has been that the oil market has been subject to macro support within the ICE market platform. That's what it was actually created for by its founders. So that's my, you know, radical thinking.
Well, since we're short a panelist this week, I'm going to weigh in with my own views. I think that the market is basically spinning its wheels, trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Clearly, the gap up open that we saw in the futures market on Sunday evening was all about the G20 and the message about China and the United States is back on or is called a truce or something. And all of a sudden, it's just gangbusters to the upside. And then we realize that, you know, OPEC didn't do anything special other than what everyone was expecting. And people thought, well, okay, maybe it's all down. And then I think this afternoon, my guess is what really caused the turnaround today, which I was not expecting, why gasoline led the way up, I have no idea. But I think it was the S&P 500 breaking above 3,000, which a lot of people were not expecting. And people are saying, wait a minute, you know, the whole idea was that there's economic slowdown, there's a reduction of demand, there's too much supply, and we're headed toward a recession, and that's why oil prices should go down. You've got the stock market breaking out to new all-time highs. Well, okay, wait a minute. And I think it's just a very confused market state. And I'm not sure what's next. I want to think that there's more downside in this market because I do think it's oversupplied. But there's a lot of conflicting signals, to say the least.
I think you are absolutely right, Eric, and there is a lot of confusion right now, and I think a couple of things I want to highlight there. There's no doubt, and also as Chris said, that there's a lot of players in the oil market today who has never seen an oil barrel, has got no interest in oil apart from the signal it sends or the role it plays in the global economy, i.e. it's a play on economic growth and economic developments, and that's why we're seeing it being quite reactive to economic data and when trends are starting to emerge in terms of slowdown. And that's why we've seen this current recession risk that is out there is having this has had this negative impact on crude oil, because it's not as if there's a major shift on a day-to-day basis in the supply and demand. So a lot of macro noise is coming in and hitting the market. But the story about the stock market and the link to the real economy is a very strange one right now. We are releasing our Q3 outlook tomorrow, Thursday, and one of the themes we are looking at from this on the stock market is really this disconnect we are seeing between leading indicators and the U.S. stock market. It's as disconnected as it's been since 2007, and the jump we had today has nothing to do with growth. It basically has to do with Trump. Seems like he's about to appoint two new members to the U.S. Federal Reserve. One of them have spoken out lot about U.S. interest rates having to go to zero. And this is the sugar rush that the stock market has been benefiting from, together with buybacks now for the past few years, which is continuing to bring buyers into that market. Just staying on that, we're getting a little bit macro here, but I think it's important from an oil perspective as well. We have to remember there's almost $13 trillion worth of bonds around the world, especially in secure bonds, which are currently providing you a negative yield. If you're an investor in Europe, you're not picking up a positive yield unless you go really, really risky. And that means the stock market is really one of the places you can go in order to at least try to get some return. So we are continuing to move higher, and the market is trying to react to that as we did today. But there has to be a great deal of skepticism involved with the underlying strength that can justify a move like that.
Chris Cook, your reactions.
Yeah, well, let's go macro here. I love this. You know, when we saw oil at $45 a barrel, you know, back in 1st of July 2017, when the whole energy dominance thing started, which I think was a seminal point in market development, what happens when oil goes, you know, $1 per barrel? Well, what happens is you've got an additional $100 million a day, which is, what's that, $3.6 trillion a year, okay? And that's before we even talk about gas, okay, which used to be oil linked but isn't. Now, that is essentially what I would call economic rent. It's profit above cost going from consumers to producers. So somebody like China, who is actually taking, you know, they've got, let's say, 10 million barrels a day. They're getting seriously hit by this rise from, you know, $45 to $65 a barrel. You know, that is serious money being taken in economic rent from producers. You know, consumers are having to pay that to producers. And this, in my opinion, is the cause, direct cause of recession, because oil fuels the other commodities and there is an energy element. You know, aluminium is what, 40%? Is it now the cost of aluminium is, you know, is energy? All right, a lot of that's renewables now. But my point is that I believe that oil is overpriced, considerably overpriced, unsustainably overpriced, okay? And that is my macro view on this. I don't think that's sustainable, and I think we're going to see some major changes as a result of this. I think also that Russia and Aramco and the Saudis understand this. You know, all this about disinvestment we're getting at the moment, you know, a divestment. Well, I mean, the Saudis and the Russians are divesting. The game's over, in my opinion, for oil. We're talking, you know, the Stone Age didn't end for lack of stones, and the Oil Age isn't ending for lack of oil. It's become secularly unaffordable. That's my macro view.
Well, I think ultimately we probably have to live with oil for another few good years, and that obviously still means that it has to be profitable to get it out of the ground. And if we are only seeing a number of countries who are able to do that, then I think that we could still see some upside pressure from lack of investment. But we are moving towards that point, and right now with the focus on climate is potentially accelerating it. We just had an election in Denmark, which was purely 4 years ago is immigration. Now, 4 years later, it's all about climate. Those who are talking green, talking climate, they got to pick up in the votes. And I think that's going to happen around the world. And so whether that's going to speed up remains to be seen. But it is a process that's where the ball is starting to roll faster.
I think we're at an inflection point here in the global economy. And it's interesting that Ola is Danish. I'm half Danish myself, Ola. You might not know this. So I have a lot of time for Denmark. And what they have done in the last 40 years and the policy which they have implemented has essentially been looking at a transition from, you know, if you like, a commodity economy. They were short of molecules of US freedom or anybody else's freedom 40-odd years ago. And they've basically been switching to what I call energy as a service, which is, you know, heat, cooling, mobility, power, a completely different way of actually investing in the energy which is actually delivered. And I observe, and I've been to some, you know, conferences, and I actually have been to several countries making presentations at top level on this, that what we're seeing is an evolution from a commodity economy, energy as a commodity, to energy as a service. And there is a very strong reason why this is actually happening. It's because services are not capital intensive. They are, you know, if you like, intensive in intellectual capital, i.e. they're smart. So we're seeing a trend towards services because it's capital efficient and it's also resource efficient. So I think that the big trade, the smart trade of the 21st century is essentially the swap or the swap of, you know, intellectual value, if I can call it that, for the value of carbon fuel savings. And carbon fuel savings are being made at the retail price. So I am a big, big optimist on the next few years. I think there's going to be a colossal opportunity for investment in energy efficiency, what Exxon call it the fifth fuel. I think there's a huge opportunity coming. And I don't think many people are looking at this. They're looking at renewables. We should be looking at the other end of the telescope, which is actually energy efficiency on a massive scale.
Let's move on now to our chart book. And again, listeners, you'll find the download link for the chart book on our homepage at macrovoices.com in the description of this article about today's podcast. Ole, why don't you walk us through this chart deck and tell us what we're looking at here?
Right. Yes. I'll just start off with the commitment of traders. Obviously, I know there's a lot of different views on the report, but I still think, and quite often we're dealing with a lot of clients from retail to family funds and larger investors. And I always use the, if you look at slide one, basically this is a table where there's a lot of data is crammed into. I use this as my radar, as I tend to tell our clients, because one thing is what the big guys are doing. If you are a little fish in the pond, you feel how can I get an edge when these guys are swinging around their thousands of lots? But I think the cut report is basically what is a radar for any trader, because it gives an idea about the extension of positions, the direction and the strength of the positions, and also clearly quite often the hedge funds are called the dumb money, and that expression has come because they tend to be the ones holding the biggest position when the market turns around. What people obviously tend to forget is that they're very, very good at riding the move as long as it carries on, where quite often it's very tempting to sell into strength and buy into weakness. They don't. They buy into strength and sell into weakness. And that basically means, obviously, when the market turns, they're getting caught. So we need to know, so when we can see positions are starting to get quite elevated and we suddenly start to see either a change in the fundamental or the technical outlook, it's nice to know that whether there's a big position that potentially is about to get squeezed, and we've seen this quite often. So this is basically my radar. So I'll just highlight the energy sector at the top, but there are obviously also some very interesting stuff going on across some of the other commodities. And further out to the right, just to give an idea, how is the position compared to the recent highs and lows over the past 52 weeks? The open interest, how big is that out of the total? And then just the long-short ratios, I think, is also quite often sending a signal. If there's a heck of a lot of longs in the market and not that many shorts, who's gonna buy it when the tide turns? So the long-short ratio gives an idea about how potentially exposed it is. You can see right now the gasoline long short is 20. That's so 20 longs per one short. That is that's well and good as long as the market continues to go up, but potentially a problem if we see a change in direction. So that's something, that's what I use it for. And then just the contango backwardation there, the second last column, is the market in backwardation or in contango at the front. Again, everyone knows if you like to have backwardation when you are long and you like to have contango when you're short. So that's the first slide. Moving on to number two, just highlight what we talked about, mentioned earlier, that this is the net line, which is a combined position between Brent and WTI. We had dropped down to, as I mentioned, to 400,000 lots, so that's relatively low. So there's plenty of room in the market. But we can also see that even though we had seen this pick up over the last almost months or so, at least up until the beginning of July, the markets continue to reduce their exposure, i.e. there is quite a lot of uncertainty and not much belief in any geopolitical lift in the price at this stage. And the next one is just to, on page three, just to highlight the blue line, which was that gross long that you mentioned, Eric. It's now the lowest since 2013. So just highlighting some of the uncertainty currently seen in the market, and even though recently there's been we've seen quite this big sell-off since April, the growth short in the market has not really gone that aggressively short. So it just indicates that right now there's not a clear signal to be found in the crude oil market. But keep it as a radar. There's always something popping up. I'm posting these every Sunday on my Twitter feed. So if you want to follow that, you can pick that table up on the Sunday and just prepare yourself for the week ahead. The status report from today, you mentioned that already, Eric. I think some of the things that has been troubling the crude oil market recently is the inventories. As you can see on the top left, we are still quite a bit above the five-year average. We are also well above where we were the same time last year. Gasoline inventory is more or less coming down towards the longer-term average. Distillates currently below. And then we got the Cushing, where we stay above the five-year average, is putting some pressure on the spreads. We are getting some pipelines open now from the shale oil regions, from Permian down towards the Gulf. So that may divert some flows away from Cushing, which potentially could have an impact on inventory. So that's going to be interesting to follow. Motor gas supplied, i.e. a signal for how the consumption is relatively healthy. This is a four-week average, but we have been close to 10 million on a week-by-week basis. But we are relatively high there. And then just the bottom one, just to give an idea about how dramatically this rise in exports has impacted the net. We are quite a bit well below the five-year average, but obviously some volatility there on a week-to-week basis. And then just a couple of look at the charts I'm watching. We can see that we've had a lot of congestion, almost a traffic jam of moving averages close to where we were trading most of last week, and that it basically just left the market left me with the view that we were about to see a major break. And you can see we got the false break on Monday and then the real breakdown yesterday. But that whole area where we got 50, 100 and 200 day moving average, that's really going to be the key in terms of resistance if we should see this market recover here in the short term. And then I like Fibonacci's just to give an idea about how strong or weak a correction or a change in the market is. And so far, you can see we just dipped below the 38.2% correction or retracement. So far, this is just a relatively weak correction within the recent uptrend. So, but overall, it doesn't look that healthy. And I think there is a risk down towards 54.30. Brent crude on slide 6, it's a little bit more clear there with the numbers, where we had this quadruple top last week, struggling to break above 66. And then today and yesterday, we have managed to find support at 62.25. That was really the last level standing in support before there is a risk we could return to the low. So 62.25 is really the level I'll keep an eye on next week. And then the so-called golden crosses is also sometimes I'm not quite sure how many traders actually use them. I think it's more something the media likes to pick up because it's something to relatively nice to report and relate to. But actually, for a change, the golden cross we've had over the past couple of days, where the 50 crosses below the death cross, it is when it's in the down direction. For these movements really to be valid, they have to have the same direction when the crossover happens. And you can see both the 200 and the 50-day moving average both are pointing lower when the crossover happened yesterday. And that to me tells me that there's a risk of some additional weakness in the market. So in the short term, potentially weakness, further weakness to come. But I think overall, a 60-70 range is more or less what we can expect over the coming weeks and months. Potentially, if we should see a bit of slowdown in U.S. shale growth, then we may see the market try an attempt higher later in the year. But I don't think it's going to come anytime soon.
Well, Ole, I can't thank you enough for being with us on the panel on this holiday week. You told me off the air that you've got to get to a client meeting this afternoon. And I can tell you right now, once Chris gets going on forward curves, it could take a while. So let's modify our schedule a little bit. Ole, why don't you tell us what you're going to be watching for in the week ahead? We'll let you drop off the call, and then Chris and I will go deep on the subject of forward curves.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. Well, I think the we just need to just basically have to look at what happened on Monday. We had weaker numbers coming from China and then followed by weaker numbers from US. So basically, the market is really in economic data watch right now. OPEC is out of the way. Again, maybe this, we could see a deterioration in the Middle East situation. But right now, I don't think Trump has any appetite for a fight at this stage with an election having to be fought next year. So economic data is really the key. So you said next week, but I think we actually almost just have to look at this week on Friday when we got the job report, just looking for any further signs of weakness starting to build up in the system. And also with that, some of the input we're going to get from the other markets, I think especially bonds, because interest rates are really king right now. And if we see any further deterioration or weakness in interest rates, that is the market sending a signal that all is not well, even though stock markets are trying to tell you something differently. So macro, watch the data and watch the interest rates.
And finally, before we let you go to your meeting, just give us your Twitter handle as well as where people can follow your work and find out more about what you do at Saxo Bank.
Well, I work at Saxo Bank. We're headquartered in Copenhagen, but we're basically covering, we've got branches around the world covering anything from retail up to high net worth individuals, family funds. You can follow me on Twitter. My name is Ollie_S_Hansen, S-E-N. And otherwise, we publish reports on home.saxo, where you can find us under Insights.
Fantastic. Well, we'll look forward to getting another update from you, Ola, when you return in a few weeks. Listeners, for the rest of the show, we're going to talk about crude oil forward curves, which happens to be a subject that both Chris Cook and I share a lot of passion for. And it's going to be very interesting for me to see how this goes and how much of Chris's views and mine jibe with one another. Because frankly, when you get into this subject of what causes the forward curves to take the shape they do, what that shape means, what it tells us about the direction of the underlying and so forth, frankly, I think that it resembles religion more than science, and a lot of people have different views. I want to start with a listener question which we received, and referring to chart number 7 in our chart deck, the green term structure that you see there. And again, just to describe for anyone who's not familiar with the concept of a forward curve, each one of these little dots represents a different delivery month. So the leftmost dot that you see is the August delivery contract, and the next one after that is September, October, November, December. And the futures markets have different contracts actively trading all the way out to 2028. The shape that the different prices, and each of these prices that you see are the most recent price. Now, this particular chart was taken a week or two ago. It was on 6/17, so it's not quite up to date with where we are today, but it's very representative. And what you see here is a very different shape. The Brent chart, which is the green series at the top, you see that the leftmost contract, that's the near delivery contract, is the highest price, and the price just goes down precipitously from there. That condition is called backwardation, and normally what it means is that there is a shortage of something. The price to get it right now is higher than the price if you're willing to wait a few months and take delivery later. But if we look at the WTI curve, you'd think we're talking crude oil and crude oil. It's almost the same thing. It's just a different delivery location. Why would it be that the front of the WTI curve is in contango, meaning that each successive delivery month, at least for the first 4 or 5 months on the strip there, are in contango with each successive price being higher than the one before it? Now, I'm going to give my answer to that question, and I won't be surprised if Chris subscribes to a different branch of religion than I do, because I'll certainly be the first to admit that this is something that not everyone agrees on. What I believe is going on here is that the Brent curve is reflecting supply and demand considerations. There is a lot of expectation of tightness in the market. That's the reason you see the nearest dated contract, the August delivery contract, at the highest price. But why is WTI different? In my opinion, the answer centers entirely on the fact that the Brent contract is cash settled. It's based on the spot market for North Sea Brent crude. But the futures contract has no delivery option. You can't stand for delivery and collect oil from your futures contract. You have to settle it in cash. The U.S. benchmark, West Texas Intermediate Crude, the yellow series at the bottom, works differently. It's possible for traders to stand for delivery and actually accept delivery of crude oil from the tank storage farm in Cushing, Oklahoma. And what that means is that it creates a different dynamic where the people who are in the storage business that operate large storage tanks, the way they get paid for being in that business is they have a long position, the oil in their tank, physical long crude oil, and it is offset exactly by a corresponding number of short futures contracts. So they're not taking any market risk. They've got the same amount of shorts as they have longs, but the shorts are in the form of futures contracts. And what that means is that when there's contango at the front of the strip, each time that guy who's got a storage tank rolls his short position forward, he's actually making money because he is buying at a low price and then selling at a higher price, and he's still hedged by the oil in his tank. Now, if the front of the curve starts to move into a condition of backwardation, similar to the way the Brent curve is, what that does is it creates an incentive for that guy who's got oil in his tank to just say, hey, I'm not getting paid anything to keep the oil in my tank. I'm going to deliver that oil into the market. And when he does that, it's putting downward pressure on just the front month price. And it's the front month that's dragging down the next three or four contracts with it. And then eventually, after the effect of that, what I call storage effect, wears off 6 or 7 months down the curve, you get into a pattern of backwardation, which very much matches what we see in the Brent contract. And I believe that the difference in the shape of the WTI curve and the shape of the Brent curve is entirely attributable to the fact that Cushing, Oklahoma is a storage location, whereas the Brent contract doesn't involve any storage or physical delivery of oil. Chris Cook, that is my version of forward curve religion. How does it match with your version of why these different curves have different shapes?
Well, this is an interesting subject. I mean, I go way back, you know, old man of the markets. I was a director of the International Petroleum Exchange in charge of market supervision, regulation, and I got into sort of development from 1990 onwards. And back in 1990, the Brent contract was just that. It was the Brent field alone. The other fields had not then joined it. The Brent field had plenty of oil coming out of it then. And it's always been cash settled, but that doesn't mean to say that it's not actually related to the underlying trade. It is. But it's the actual physical, what happens is, The Brent contract is rather different in structure because there is, in fact, an underlying contract, an underlying forward physical contract, in the same way that the stock exchange index has an underlying basket of stocks. So it is the case that the Brent contract essentially has an underlying basket of crude oil. And that physical crude oil does take delivery in the physical market, but it takes place a few weeks after the contract expires. You'll see that the Brent contract is always coming off the board a month or maybe a little bit more than the WTI contract, which is physically settled to a different cycle. So what happens is, on the expiry date, the index is calculated by reference to all of the reported underlying physical forward transactions in the market. And at that point, the cash index is settled. But there is a whole raft of contracts which the professional traders are trading. They are then trading these forward contracts until they come themselves to expiry. They then get exercised into spot deliveries. And we're now looking at the Brent field, the Forties field, the Oseberg field, the Ekofisk field, and a new one, new kid on the block, called the Troll field, because they're constantly having to introduce new oil because as the existing, you know, fields expire. And bottom line is that it is very much actually based on real oil and real trading, but it's a very complex basket of contracts, including contracts for difference and all sorts of things. It's not called the Brent complex for nothing. So my analysis of the difference is in fact, and it's back to what I've been saying for some considerable time, that it is possible through manipulation, through cornering the market in these physical transactions. And this has been routine on the Brent contract since it began, long, you know, even before I started at the International Petroleum Exchange. It was a little marketplace for consenting adults to squeeze each other on the forward trades, but the retail customers were not actually involved in it. But more and more, what we're finding is that these sort of trader games and whatnot do impact the market. But it has become possible, and this is, in my view, what has been happening, to actually control the price because of very, very few cargoes. You need to control the cargoes in order to control the price. And when they say the market is tight, it doesn't mean to say there are buyers. What it may well mean is that there are no sellers. And that's a very, very different point. My point being that the reason there are no sellers and the market is tight is that these cargoes may well be subject to having been pre-sold, this prepay, which is my sort of fundamental reason for believing that this is how the market has been supported on and off for many years. So that's the sort of explanation. I believe that the price is artificially being held up on the spot. And then, you know, if you like, the rest of the curve hangs off it. You know, that is my explanation for the difference, is that the spot price is deliberately supported by the absence of contracts for sale on the physical market. That's my explanation for what it's worth.
Okay, Chris, this chart on slide number 7 was supplied by a listener who asked us to comment on that difference in the shape of the curves and why it occurred. I want to move on now. You've done a lot more research than I have on term structure of, or forward curves, essentially different words for the same thing, the shape of the forward strip. Why don't you walk us through and tell us all about your views on what has occurred, the history of how this market has evolved, and what it means.
Right. Thanks very much for that, Eric. I'd like to take us way back in time again to 1990, which is when I first started at the International Petroleum Exchange. Back in those days, you see, there was no curve. Okay, there wasn't a curve. When I started at the IPE, the Brent contract, the third month had never even traded or very rarely traded, only at the maybe in the first few days after a contract expired. So there was no participation. There was no trading beyond that. Gas oil was a slightly different question. And then gradually over time, the market started to sort of extend. And the reason was, you see, in the early days, it was purely and simply about Shell in particular and BP. These are the people who had oil in the North Sea that was being priced against this benchmark. These guys were basically selling forward. And on the buy side of the contract, of course, you had refiners who were buying forward. So, you know, you didn't really have anybody else apart from, you know, we found a few speculators in those days. But this was long before hedge funds came along. You know, there really weren't any hedge funds to speak of back then. You had professional traders back in those days. But basically, you had the producers, you had the refiners, and a few professional traders were beginning to come along. And that was back in the early days. But there was nobody buying even in month 3. That's how it was back then. There wasn't a curve. Then over the next 2 or 3 years, because I was there until 96, we saw really exciting times in the market. It was after the first Gulf War, when IPE just boomed at that point. And what we then saw was the entry into the market of what became known as the Wall Street refiners. You know, players like Goldman, J. Aron, it was, you know, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, one or two other guys started, we had Phibro started, you know, these are all names, most of which have disappeared since then. But they started, they called them Wall Street refiners because they were basically, they were taking physical oil, trading it, and then selling the gasoline. They were making a market in financial oil and products. And then what happened, you know, by about 94 or so, the really smart people at Goldman Sachs came up with a new product. They called it the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, GSCI, and started marketing this. And this essentially was a fund which, you know, was buying, if you like, paper commodities, and they were doing it on the futures markets. So they were going long of the futures, whereas the market was short. Now, bear in mind that the producers always wanted to sell further forward than they could. They wanted to hedge as far out as they could, you know, because if you can hedge, if you can sell your production forward, it means you can lock in your price, and that makes, you know, budgeting that much easier, and it enables you to have certainty for when you've got new capital investment. So producers, on the one hand, had this unfulfilled need for hedging. And BP was the big boy back then on the rent contract. They were structurally short, as we say. But there was nobody on the buy side to take the other side of this. And then along came Goldman Sachs from 94.5. And we then started to see the curve gradually started to become populated, because the fund started coming in on the buy side. You know, they were the first. And I was involved in market innovations. I brought in trading at settlement because there was a requirement for that. These are all technical devices, but were needed by the market. And what we then saw gradually was that the curve started to be populated. But it was always financial buyers further down the curve. And again, the smart guys at BP and Goldman realized that actually there's some interesting synergy here, because, you know, you've got the fund on the one side who are actually going long of the market, and BP on the other are short of the market. And that's a nice sort of match position in a sense. And gradually what we saw was that, I don't think it's any accident that the same guy, Peter Sutherland, was chairman of BP for 20 years from about 95. And he was also the chairman of Goldman Sachs for 10 years. I don't think that's an accident. I think, you know, the two companies basically were a good fit because of the activities in the market were complementary. So what we then saw over the, you know, I left the exchange in 96 and got involved in other stuff, sort of financial technology, they call it these days. But I was still interested in what was going on the market. And then by 2001, we then saw Enron come along. A new tool entered the toolkit at that point, because Enron, you know, 70% of their income never existed. And the reason it didn't exist is that they were actually funding themselves in opaque transactions called prepay deals. And they were essentially defrauding their creditors and investors by doing that. And what that meant was that it became possible for other players in the market, so minded, to actually say, okay, well, what we're going to do is actually use the markets to fund by prepayment for oil inventory. You can actually monetize your reserves. It's a cheap way of interest-free financing, actually. And so we saw from about 2001 onwards, at that point, that is why, in my opinion, the Intercontinental Exchange was formed, that this technique, and it was formed by Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were the founders. Some of the big oil companies, BP and whatnot, came in, and they essentially took control of the oil market complex. They introduced a benchmark for the Saudi oil called the Brent Weighted Average, BWAVE, came along, and essentially they took control, ICE, of the global oil market platform. And then over the years that followed, we gradually saw develop, as the market developed, as new investors came into this new financial product. They called it inflation hedging. It was a great line. You know, people are not, you know, if the interest rates come down and you don't trust the dollar anymore, what do? You're attracted into assets like, if you're getting zero interest, you know, why do you want your money in dollars? You know, you'd rather have something solid like gold or oil or any commodity. And that meme of inflation, you know, hedging inflation came along. And if you think about it, what an inflation hedger, what I call a passive investor, is doing. And now we get into the nitty gritty of why the curve is sort of the shape it is and the motivations of it. An inflation hedger is not doing the same as a speculator. These massive positions in the market, which is, know, tell me now, Eric, why are hedge funds who are risking their capital systemically long for 15 to 20 years? Hedge funds, they're at the front of the curve. They're taking punts. You know, this is what speculation is all about. You're risking your capital in expectation of profit. These investors, these passive investors, are doing the exact opposite. They are offloading risk. They're risk averse. They're offloading dollar risk and taking on oil risk. That's what they're doing. And their motivation in the market and the way in which they actually are active, rather, you know, they're passive rather than active, that affects the actual oil price, you know, the price formation. Mike Masters said this to Congress in 2008 and was roundly condemned by the industry, but he was spot on. Passive investment kills price formation in the, if you like, the fundamental value investing. And it's not just in oil it does it. It does it in everything.
Chris, excuse me for interrupting, but I want to move the conversation forward and ask a question you have posed over and over again on Twitter, and I've never seen anyone come up with a credible answer to, which is, okay, we all know that about 2 years out on the curve, the bankers are selling futures. The question is, who is buying the other side of that trade? Who is buying those futures 2 years out on the curve? Now, I've done some research on this. After seeing you ask this question, I've talked to people who are quite expert in this field and said, okay, is it refiners? Everybody says, no, refiners generally, airlines, you know, anybody who's hedging, they are buying maybe 1 year out at most, and the hedgers need to be selling 2+ years out. So it's not any other hedger that's on the other side of a hedge. It's somebody else. So have you ever come across any credible answer to that question you keep asking? And for that matter, do you have any answer of your own?
Well, I'm with you. You're much better informed in terms of talking to the market players, Eric. I haven't heard anything, which is why I keep asking the question. But my answer is that the financial buyers out there, the motivation has changed, but there is a lump of capital sitting out there on the other side of the market. The label is essentially, or has been, funds, let's call it that. And then the question is, what is their motivation? I believe that the motivation is that it is not just for them a financial trade. The people I have in mind are, for instance, producers like probably the Saudis. I think it has at all times been the Saudis in the last couple of years. So the Saudis have a lump of capital there in the market. They have a market position, but they have a physical book. You know, they're producing however many million barrels a day they produce. So that If they can actually support the price, history shows that they will. This is commodity market 101. If the Saudis can support the price, they will. And through the intervention of the Brent complex, through the ability to to support the price, what it means is that they, even if they make a loss on these hedges, which that depends on the actual structure of the market, but even if they do make a loss on these hedges, they're going to make a multiple of profit from the inflated oil price, which they're able to actually, you know, with the people they're playing with on the market, they're actually able to control. So I think the Saudis are essentially funding the inventory, which you, in order to manipulate a market, you have to be able to fund inventory. You know, the tin market was funded for 30 years by tin producers until they ran out of money.
Now, hang on a second, Chris. Let me play this back and make sure that I'm understanding it. What you're saying here is that if the hedgers, the shale hedgers in the United States, all have to sell futures 2 years out on the curve, if they were allowed to do that in a market which really has no natural buyers 2 years out on the curve that I'm aware of, what would happen is that would push that very illiquid part of the market down so far that it would drag the front of the curve down with it. It would pull oil prices down. And what you're saying is you believe or you speculate that Saudi Arabia is making what are probably losing trades, buying those hedges, not because they think it's a brilliant idea, but because they have so much more to gain by not allowing the selling that those hedgers are doing to pull the price down, keeping the price elevated. They don't care if they lose a little bit on those futures trades, because what they're doing is they're supporting the spot price where all of the really heavy volume occurs, and which allows them to get paid more for their oil. Is that essentially the summary of what you believe is driving this?
Yeah, because it takes us back to earlier in the conversation. You see, for me, the natural state of a market without all these interesting additional middlemen is a contango, because anybody who buys forward will not buy forward unless there's a discount. You know, this is like commodity 101. So that, you know, contango only comes along if somebody in some way is prepared to fund it. Okay. And that might well be that the seller is prepared to accept different prices for the, you know, the seller might actually have excessive production and therefore the contango comes from that. But you see, what's happened with the financial intermediation and these other motivations is that other people become interested in funding inventory for different reasons. And the history of, you know, commodity markets is that producers have an overriding reason to actually fund inventory if they can. That's precisely what happened in tin. It happened in other markets too. There's a saying, Eddie, that the cure for high prices is high prices and the cure for low prices is low prices. And that's precisely it, that, you know, a long-term high price is not sustainable because eventually the money is going to run out.
Okay, so your theory is essentially that Saudi Arabia makes so much more money from having a high spot price that they can afford to do what would otherwise be seemingly foolish moves in the futures market in order to keep the back end of the curve from collapsing under the weight of those hedge-driven sales that have to occur in order to hedge outside production.
Absolutely so, Eric. And also, the other cost of doing this trade is the maintenance of the spot prices in the Brent complex. Whoever is funding the inventory is not the person who's actually involved in the North Sea, shall we say, manipulation. But then again, in the North Sea, who is it benefits from high prices? Well, the answer there is it's the Norwegians now. Norwegians are actually taking over as a sort of main production in the North Sea, and the Brits are sort of falling off. Well, guess what? 1st of January 2019, the former head of Statoil became the chairman of BP. You know, where it used to be a BP-Goldman Sachs partnership, now it's a BP-Equinor partnership. Those guys have an interest in maintaining North Sea benchmark prices at very, very high levels. So I'm sorry, but in my view, the players have changed, you know, but the game is the same.
Chris, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. I hope that our several listeners who have asked for a deep dive on this topic of forward curves in crude oil got what they wanted from this. Before I let you go, I want to ask you the same question I asked Ole, which is independent of curves in the markets generally, what are you going to be watching in the week ahead?
Yeah, I'm going to be watching the Straits of Hormuz, no question. We've seen some very dangerous near misses, and hopefully common sense will prevail. And I think the next few days should give us the answers to that.
And you know, something that Pippa Malmgren points out to me in an episode of Macro Voices All-Stars, which is not going to air until Friday morning this week, is, you know, it's easy to say, President Trump is smart enough to not let a war happen in an election year. But really, if you look at history, a war in an election year is not a bad thing for the incumbent president. It tends to align citizens in the interest of patriotism behind the sitting president. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in terms of the geopolitics and Iran and so forth. And who knows, something spooked the market this afternoon on Wednesday that I wasn't expecting. Maybe somebody's got the word on something that I don't have. In any case, listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town and that we intend to become the definitive weekly information source for energy traders, investors, and others interested in energy markets. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes or at macrovoices.com, and you'll also gain access to our Thursday night podcast, which has a much more general macroeconomic focus. We're also looking for sponsors so that we can keep Macro Voices content free for you, the listener. Now, to save you time on the podcast so I don't have to give you all the gory details, I've prepared a detailed video explaining the opportunity for sponsoring Energy Week and other Macro Voices content. You can find that video at macrovoices.com/sponsor info. If your company is interested in sponsoring Macro Voices Energy Week or any of our other content, please email me at info@macrovoices.com. Before we close, I just want to ask you, Chris, tell us your Twitter handle and where people can look in order to follow your work and see what else you're working on.
Yep, my Twitter handle is CJENSCOOK. That's C Jens Cook. And that's the best place to find my views. I'm not slow in sharing them on Twitter.
Macro Voices Energy Week is released every Wednesday evening. Next week's panel includes Art Berman, Anas Alhaji, and Tracy Shukart. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. See you next week, everybody. And Americans, have a fantastic 4th of July holiday.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.